Many Christians, it seems to me, get very anxious if they think their ministers or their churches get too political. Archbishop Helder Camara once famously said, "When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist." We have a rather anxious relationship with politics in the church, and we try hard not to be seen as being partisan or too divisive. And I preached this sermon this morning in the local Methodist church, where the local MP was there, and he shook my hand afterwards, so I probably did okay. This anxiety about politics is a little ironic, given the opening of St. Mark's Gospel, which Susan just read to us. The opening words, "This is the good news about Jesus Christ, the Son of God," are deeply political and incredibly subversive. But because we don't live in the culture that Mark was writing for, we miss the politics and the subversion. The term of good news, the Greek word is, I can't even pronounce it, euangelion, isn't a term that Mark found in the Old Testament or the Jewish faith. Its use in the ancient world, until the church came along, was limited to palace news. If the emperor had a child, that was good news. If the emperor signed a treaty, or gave bread to the poor, or had a circus, or announced a holiday, or got married, or cut his toenails, this was all good news, and it was announced with great flummery that this was amazing stuff, this was good news. Remember too that Roman emperors also claimed divinity for themselves. So it was good news about someone who was semi-divine or someone who was a god. Mark, by using this term, good news, is making his readers realise that the good news isn't about the doings of some daft emperor with odd ideas above his station, but it's all about Jesus, the Son of God. So Mark is making a profoundly political statement. He's critiquing the emperor and the whole imperial system, whilst at the same time making claims about Jesus that are more properly in the ancient world made about the Roman emperor. And that's just his opening sentence. The context matters here too. When Mark was compiling his gospel in around the year 70, there was a war on. The Jews had revolted against Rome. Jerusalem was under siege and would soon be destroyed. After the emperor Nero died, who wasn't the best of the Roman emperors, four men came along that were proclaimed emperor and were assassinated pretty quickly afterwards. So there was great instability. Some Jewish people supported the rebels in Israel against Rome. Some saw Rome as a place of peace and security and therefore weren't in favour of the rebellion. But there was one tiny sect of Jews which kept out of it. That sect was the Christians. Rabbis labelled them as heretics. The zealots thought they were ineffective collaborators because they wouldn't join in with the revolution. So to help his readers understand their troubled situation, Mark proclaims Jesus. But to understand Jesus, he looks back to the scriptures of Israel. He stresses the continuity between Jesus' message and all that has gone before him in the Jewish faith. But he also looks forward to Jesus as the future of the world, the coming of the kingdom, all the things that we dream of. The Isaiah passage which Ellen read to us is also proclaiming good news, but in a very different context. The passage was written when the Jewish people were in exile and longing for deliverance. Isaiah's message is that things were as bad as they could be. They are in exile. Their national life has been destroyed. The temple lies in ruins. But God is faithful and compassionate. God is forgiving and is about to act So all the Jews need to do is to wait expectantly for God's deliverance to come. Salvation is at hand. But the salvation that is at hand in Isaiah isn't what was expected. The long-promised Messiah was thought to be a political leader. Back to politics again. Maybe a prophet, maybe a king, maybe a rabble-rouser, who would free Israel from its fallen bondage. The Messiah will make Israel strong again, as in the days of King David. This was what was wanted, and who could blame them? After exile in Babylon, invasion by the Greeks, and oppression by the Romans, hope was to be found in a resurgent nationalism, where people would be able to decide their own destiny. But this isn't the salvation that Mark promises. Salvation is proclaimed by Mark, but it isn't what the Jews had longed for in the past. Instead, it's God's very self living with his people on earth. A theme of Mark's gospel is the idea that Jesus had a mission to bind the strong man, Satan, who holds humanity in its grasp. And the powers of Satan are the powers of despair, disease, and demon possession, as well as the power of death. In the face of these powers, humanity is helpless. Yet these powers are not abstract things, because to Mark, they have human faces. They're vested in the powers of Rome, the temple system of Jesus' day. They're the powers that kill messiahs, as they will kill Jesus. They have the last word until Jesus' coming. They're the powers that have reigned throughout human history, thwarting God's purposes for good. Mark's message is that until Jesus, the only victories have been against the agents of those powers, Pharaoh of old, Babylon, the Greeks. In Jesus, according to St. Mark's Gospel, the very source of that power, the strong man, is going to be confronted and defeated. This is good news, and is eventually seen in the resurrection, where the powers of death are defeated. The good news, then, isn't what's happening in the imperial family. It isn't like a celebrity gossip magazine. But it's what God is up to in Jesus, in binding the power of the evil one and inaugurating the coming kingdom. This is powerful political stuff. As Roman power was dominant in Europe and Middle East at the time, Mark was writing in a situation of Roman occupation in which rebellion was a political crime that carried the death sentence. Jesus was finally crucified as a political agitator. This, then, is a bold proclamation that is deeply subversive. The good news is, after all, about a divine figure, just not the emperor. It's about Jesus, who's coming to overthrow the powers. Caesar will be shown for what he is, a pretender to the divine throne. It's the kingdom proclaimed and brought near by Jesus that will prevail, not Caesar. St. Mark starts his good news off with this strange figure of John the Baptist. It's important to Mark to show that John is the last of the Old Testament prophets. All that attention to what John was wearing, and especially to what he was eating, locusts and wild honey, make him sound like the famous Jewish prophet Elijah. John, according to Mark, was the last of the old. Jesus is the new thing that God is doing. The interesting thing for me is what God is doing in John the Baptist, and what later he does in Jesus, happens in the wilderness, or the desert, I think the translation we used had. God isn't at work in a royal palace, but a woman's lap. God isn't at work in the corrupt leaders of the day, but in the wilderness, the place where Israel found freedom and had its identity formed. God isn't at work at the centre of the stage, but at the edge. So what does all this fascinating history have to do with us? The church in these islands is having to get used to being on the edge, to being marginal, to being ignored. It's come from a place of power and prestige to a place largely of irrelevance, with lower numbers, less influence, and a sense of being a minority activity. We're finding ourselves in the wilderness. Some Christians try very hard to deny this is the reality. I'm told that when Archbishop Welby went for the interview to become Archbishop of Canterbury, he, along with all the other candidates, were given some internal polling figures showing the number of people that go to an Anglican church on a Sunday. And the figures, I think, are much worse than what is published publicly. And all the other candidates tried to say this isn't really the case. You know, if we look at who comes midweek and it was a bad Sunday and things generally are really well, look at the number of funerals we do. Justin Welby was the only one to say, yeah, it's probably going to get worse. But because he could face up to that, evidently, according to this newspaper article I read, didn't write it, I'm not that influential, they were impressed because he was able to see the church as it really is and to make some suggestions about how it may stem the flow. Other Christians work really hard to try and regain that power and influence that they've lost. Jenny Ann, there's a lady outside. I think she may be looking for next door, she may be looking for here, but she looks rather lost. Thank you. I think the church could learn much from St. Mark's portrayal of the good news and embrace the wilderness. In the wilderness, we see the world in a different way. We see the powerful and what motivates them and compare and contrast this to the coming kingdom. In the wilderness, we see who is left out, who is excluded from society in which we live, and see more clearly how to help them. In the wilderness, we can hold a mirror up to our society so it can see itself as God sees it. In the wilderness, we can, like the Jews of old, find our freedom and find ourselves formed anew. After all, the witness of Scripture is that God is at work on the outside. We can't do any of these things if we're in a position of power. We can't be overly political if we are at the centre of all things. St. Mark calls us to prepare the way of the Lord, to meet the Lord in the wilderness, and to recognise the powers and authorities of this world and to realise that they don't have the power that they think they do. Only Jesus, only his kingdom matter. Only Jesus has the power to bind the powers of this world and to create the kingdom, the new world where all will be free, all will be valued, all will be loved, and where God will live in our midst. This is our Advent hope. This is our good news.